Hutton than with laryngitis, but they didn't give me a choice. I could have retreated with honor and not done this broadcast live. Everybody at the station is saying, Barry, why didn't you use an old tape? We have a lot of old tapes. And I think the answer will become implicit as my voice fades throughout this broadcast. A lot of broadcasters have moments where they're secretly saying to themselves, can this really be happening to me? Not too many like to admit it. It's not cool. It's not fashionable. But I am throbbing right now with those impulses. I can't believe that this is really happening to me, that I'm really sitting 3 feet away across a broadcast table from the men and women who made Monitor. While we're together, we will cover Monitor from the beginning until what seems like the end, and into the future, which will continue to vibrate and ricochet through the recollections of those of us who were strongly not just propelled and impelled and compelled to listen to Monitor, but into the future of those of us who were deeply, everlastingly influenced by what NBC's Monitor meant to American broadcasting and to us. Let's do like the French Foreign Legion did and take a sword and draw a line in the sand in the desert and see who's on which side. Here's the sword and here's the sand. Does this mean to you what it means to me? If you are locked in anything less than nostalgic rapture, then that does not mean quite to you what it means to me. And I give you an amnesty, because I hope before we're through our deliberations in this broadcast, it will mean retroactively everything it means to me. That's the signature melody of Monitor. Those were the beeps that convinced me that broadcasting had a future, and that I couldn't imagine anybody being in any other field until he flunked out convincingly of broadcasting. It was in the early 1950s, the mid-1950s, I forget which, when I first heard that sound and heard that Monitor was on the air. The first show was radio and television simulcast, and then Monitor dominated weekends all over the United States on every single NBC station. The microphone I'm speaking into is not an NBC station. The radio station you're listening to right now might not be an NBC station, but out of the sheer open-heartedness of Americans who revere broadcasting at its finest, I'm calling upon every single station who carries my show, regardless of its network affiliation, to go ahead and open their heart and open their mics and let us honor what NBC did from 1955 until 1974 in Monitor. I have laryngitis. This is not my natural voice, and I suspect if I were to go to a team of psychiatrists and physiologists and throat experts, they would examine me and find nothing really that they could pin this laryngitis on. I guess they'd simply have to say that I was overcome with what I was about to do on this radio show at this time. It's like, or I feel like a little kid who said, Mommy, can I meet my heroes? And she said, yes, Barry, you can meet them, but be patient, you're gonna wait 20 years. And when that time was up and I finally sat 3 feet away from the men and women who made Monitor, I lost not my ability to walk, not my ability to think, but I did lose my ability to talk, and it's a pretty good investment. My partners deployed across the broadcast table right now are Steve White, executive producer of Monitor, Bud Drake, producer-director who joined Monitor just 1 year into its career, Charles Garmett, writer, producer of Monitor, and Cappy Petrash, the first living person I ever looked at and shook hands with who was, I knew, responsible for Monitor. Ladies and gentlemen on the panel, as I'm going to tell Bob and Ray later, you influenced my fantasy so much. It was such a fantastic going places and doing things kind of format. I remember Playboy magazine played along at the time. They had a cartoon of a good-looking girl calling her girlfriend saying, I don't know what it is with this guy. He wants me to come over and listen to his favorite radio show with him. It's called Monitor. And of course, the subtle punchline was that she was going to have to be with him from early on Saturday until late on Sunday, because unlike the ordinary radio shows that lasted 15 minutes, a half hour, an hour, Monitor went on as long as you went on, and in fact longer, all weekend long. The going places and doing things was not just a promise, it was a premise. I went to so many places with so many different people. NBC has, well, I have a rotten article here from the New York Times announcing the demise of Monitor. I'm not going to read it in toto because, like most people who get what they consider bad news, I just refuse to accept it in toto. But I will read the lead verbatim from the New York Times. Headline is Monitor to End on NBC Radio. Restyled Network Service Set. You know, that's what they said when democracy died in Greece. No, really? Really? That's what the Red Army said when they occupied Lithuania in 1940. That's what unimaginative tyrants throughout history have said after the successful completion of their carnage. Restyled Network Service Set. But without further editorial, I'll read the lead. Monitor, the 20-year-old weekend potpourri of news, entertainment, and features, will be terminated in February for a new radio network service devoted primarily to news, information, and sports. NBC Radio announced yesterday. Well, I'll be listening, of course. But I doubt that it will have the magnetic, geographic, and gravitational pull on me that Monitor did. I remember I came to New York in 1956, 1 year after Monitor, and I just couldn't help myself. I went to Rockefeller Center, and I said, I'd like to take a tour. I'd like to see Monitor like everybody else in the world. And they said, oh, yes, we have a tour. But I was clever. I asked the girl, how long do you stand outside Radio Central? And upon relentless cross-examination, she broke down and admitted it was about a 5-minute stop outside Radio Central. And that was simply insufficient. My friend Don Freeman and I thanked them just the same. We ascertained from a guide who was about our age that Radio Central, as magic as it sounded, was really just the fifth floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza. And we waited till the tour left and nobody was looking, and we went into what we thought was a broom closet and found out to be the staircase. And we crept up to the fifth floor, surreptitiously and quite illegally. And we stayed pressing our noses against Radio Central, not for 5 minutes. We saw 10 tours come and go. And we sat there and fixated on Monitor. May I harvest, having delivered my recollections, may I collect some of yours, sweeping our rainbow from left to right. Introduce yourself, restate your own relationship to Monitor, and then help me out.
Well, I'm Bud Drake, and I'm one of the producer directors on the show. And I joined the show about a year after it went on the air. And my first chore on the show was to pull together an epic contest that somebody had dreamed up in a meeting one day, called The Most Beautiful Voice in America. Okay. And somebody said, oh, what a wonderful idea. Well, all our affiliates will come in on it, and we'll sell RCA equipment to the affiliates, and the affiliates will go out and record all these voices. And we never dreamed the harvest that we were going to reap, because we were just inundated with tape from all over the country, from Honolulu, all over. And it just got so big, and I was called in to replace a man who was leaving the company by the name of Alan Ludden, who later went on to fame and fortune and much success. But at that time, Alan was running this contest, and in I came, and I had to pull this thing together for 13 weeks and sort out all these voices. And at the end of this whole epic procedure, we ended up with 5 contest winners. And I was home in bed, sound asleep in the middle of the night, and the phone rang, and it was the NBC operator, and she said, Mr. Drake, we have your contest winner in Las Vegas. and they're not ready to accommodate them. And I said, good Lord, we never gave them Las Vegas as a prize on the contest. And I called another guy that had arranged all the prizes on the contest, and I said, did we give Las Vegas? And he said, no. I said, well, one of our winners is in Las Vegas. What are we going to do? And he said, go back to sleep. I'll take care of everything. Well, somehow or other, he did. And it turned out that early on in all the literature on the contest, we had offered this as speculatively, but we had never promised it. And the KGU contest winner from Honolulu had been flown into Las Vegas for a long week. And we covered it, of course. The contest winner, I'll never forget her name, Irma Jean Gertner. Ring a bell?
Where is she now?
Where is she now? She had a lovely voice, but that was her name.
Steve White.
Barry, I'll tell you a little story that you might find interesting, and I don't think too many people know this, and maybe this is the time to bring it all out. A lot of people claim that Pat Weaver was the original man behind the idea of Monitor. But I think Pat certainly had a lot to do with it. But I'd like to mention another name, a man named Charles Denny. Now, Charles Denny, back about 1954, was the head of the owned stations for the whole radio and television network.
And what you magic people call the O&Os,
that's
owned
it.
And operated.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, Charlie Denny had an idea for the program managers of the owned radio stations. And he came up with the idea that he wanted someone to come up from the owned stations with a new idea for weekends that would result in increased sales, some kind of new programming. So everybody, at that time, we owned the Cleveland station and Washington and San Francisco and, of course, New York. And in New York, we started fooling around with an idea that we called Pulse. And it was for Saturday, and it was a couple of hours on Saturday morning, and we used, you might call him an anchor man. We had other people in the field, and we used Lindsey Nelson to come in with sports. The anchor man at the time was John Wingate. We had a fellow named Fleetwood who was doing classical music. We had a gal named Sydney Smith who was doing fashion. Anyway, we got this whole thing together.
I'm getting excited all over again. Sounds great.
Anyway, this was our contribution to
this
contest, you see. Right. And this was on Saturday morning, and Mr. Denny liked this idea very much. At the same time, Mr. Denny was also on a committee to keep the radio network alive on weekends. And he liked this idea, and he brought this idea to this committee. And of course, at that time, Pat Weaver was head of the whole NBC. He was the president of the company. And that's when Mr. Weaver first heard about this idea. And then, of course, Pat took it, and he brought his own people in, and the thing took off on a whole network basis.
You heard the impact on me.
I think I
was the impact on you. I mean, did you realize, was it as exciting to you as it was to me?
It really was. I can remember at the time I was working on this idea with another fellow that you know named Bill Burns. And we were cooking it up, and we were going out to different areas of the New York City market to meet the people, see the kind of people that we'd be talking to. And then we had to come back and come up with names of the hosts. And Bill said, well, who should we put down? I said, I don't know. He said, put Dave Garraway down, because Garraway was then the big man on the Today Show. And he said, oh, he'll never do it. I said, I don't know. We'll put his name down. The next thing I know, we're in Garraway's office with a presentation, and he's sitting there eating an apple and a little ginger ale, because he was on a diet. And it's one of those easel presentations, and we're reading the idea of the whole thing to him, you know, and he says, don't read, I can read, just turn the page, please. Anyway, the show, when Pat Weaver got a hold of it, that was it, and that's when it really got on the air.
Cappy Petrasch, you're too young to have early recollections, but go ahead and deliver them.
Well, my mother told me that on June 12th, as a matter of fact, when I knew I was coming here tonight, Barry, I checked back as to what we had on that first show. And it was so, I loved the list of things. We did pickups from San Quentin Prison. And then we had an on-the-spot broadcast from Brown's Hotel in the Catskills, where Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were making a movie together.
Together, yeah.
Then we had a I guess you could call it a race with a jet plane going to London. And the bet was, we had our special correspondent on board, and the bet was that the jet would reach London before the program signed off, because we were on for 40 hours, you know, and that was a gimmick, and that was the fun. And I think the fact that we were on so long each weekend is what gave us our particular quality, because we had so many stories that we could use. And I was looking at a list, a typical weekend in 1956. We did a spot eavesdropping on fish, and we heard the underwater sounds of porpoises, toadfish, snapping shrimp. We went to a hula class graduation. We went to a reunion of airline hostesses in Lima, Peru. We spoke to the leading Australia dog judge. We heard about the, pigeon sounds. I see there's something on pigeon sounds. A Minnesota man told what it was like to be struck by lightning and still live. We visited an 8-year-old boy who had a monkey, a hoot owl, snakes, parrots. Doesn't say anything about his parents. Let's see, we heard about the deactivation of the mule batteries in Fort Carson, Colorado. Now that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great stuff, and you just can't get that anywhere anymore.
You must have had a lot of freelance people sending you in tapes, because the tape recorder was a fact when Monitor started. Incidentally, I'd like to give $1.98 prize to anybody who can tell me the real origin of the tape recorder. I've heard it attributed to Adolf Hitler, and I've never heard a version that upstaged it. We had the wire recorder right after World War II. Mm-hmm. But somebody told me Adolf Hitler invented tape so he could appear to be speaking in Dresden and appear to be speaking in Berlin and Hamburg and Stuttgart and München and Neumünster all at the same time. And this sounds like a fable, but until somebody tells me who really invented tape, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a great story. I want to believe it.
Yeah, somebody else invented it, but he used
We'll do a spot on it next week.
Before February 1st, we'll find out.
No, but somebody did give me the idea. Why don't you, if you think you're such a great reporter, why don't you go to Europe and get something that Monitor will play? Well, Monitor playing your spot, if you were a freelance sound photographer, was like being kissed by tongues of flame. There was nothing like it. Nothing like it. The front cover of Time would not be tantamount to having Monitor buy your little 3-minute tape recording from the crater of a semi-active volcano in Sicily. You know?
Well, that was the point of the show, and that's why I think it worked so well, because so many people could have access to it, and we really would accept material from people if it was good. That was the criteria. There were union rules in New York City, for example. You simply couldn't, you know, send in a tape. But other than that, people sent us stuff from all over the world, not just all over the country. And I remember one of our very best reporters was the farm editor for WHO in Des Moines. He would come up with stories that would just, you know, knock your eyes out.
Del Donahue,
marvelous, right?
Great name.
I'm sorry, Charlie Garman, colleague, hasn't had a chance to say a word. Charlie.
Charlie Garman, writer, brackets. I had the same reaction you had to hearing the show for the first time. I came on a year after it started, and only recently I dug up an old tape, you know, go through an attic closet. I found an old tape, and it was a party I had at my house with brothers and friends, and we'd been carousing. And Monitor was so much in everybody's consciousness. And this is before I was anywhere near or even involved.
Took over.
We did a parody of Monitor. It already had reached the status of such grandeur that you began doing parodies. We did a parody interview with Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay on coming down from Mount Everest. And it was really that impressive. And when someone asked me about a year later, would you like to work on the show? I said, where else? I mean, why not? And came on the show, and I said, writer on Monitor. And that brought up another problem, because for years after that, people would say, what do you do? You know, I'm a monitor. And what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a writer. And they say, what do you mean by writer? There's no writer on the show. The hosts sound as if they're making it up, ad-libbing. I said, well, that's part of
what a writer does.
What we do on Monitor. We try to fashion it so that it's loose, easy, in the style of the... we had two communicators, not one host, but two. And they were fairly well... we selected them for contrast very often, so you could get the full range, and they could play against each other, so that they not only introduced bits and pieces, they were part of the
actual entertainment. Who was it? We had...
David Brinkley.
Well, Brinkley was one. Garraway would work, since Garraway was so special, he would work with somebody who was just more or less a straight announcer.
I remembered at the time realizing that to be president of the United States, you had to suffer the the inconvenience of a free election. To be Secretary General of the UN, you had to win a vote in the General Assembly. The only exalted position on earth that you could get without an election was a communicator.
Right.
To be a monitor communicator. Somebody licked his finger and rubbed your name, and there you were.
Well, when we knew we were coming here tonight, we sat down this afternoon and we started to look back over some of the names of the people that have been on the show.
Forgive me, in a minute I want you to call the roll.
You betcha.
WOR New York. And I'm guaranteed to until my voice fades. I'm Barry Farber, my partners for the expedition, Steve White, Bud Drake, Charles Garment, and Cappy Petrash, the men and women who made up Monitor, which while it lasted was the pinnacle of broadcast perfection, provocation, excitement, really everything that exemplifies that which American broadcasting is capable of. I am proud to come from a country that could spawn a monitor, and I question the changing values of a country where the network that spawned Monitor 20 years ago can say, sorry, we're canceling Monitor for a restyled network service. What it means is that one rock and roll record after another on the hundreds of stations that made up this network is somehow more profitable and therefore more compelling and therefore more desirable and therefore more inevitable than the collected talent of the National Broadcasting Corporation to take us around the world regularly. At any given minute on a weekend, we could be any place without warning, without expectation. This was exciting. And I remember the penetrating power of Monitor, people who I went to the fifth grade with, who couldn't care less about southern Germany or Mongolia or some Icelandic ice cap. They hung on Monitor because of the production values that made every single place they took us a necessary place to visit. I feel rottenly ill that Monitor is being dropped from NBC. This is not a protest show, and it's not a nostalgia show, and it certainly is not a condolence show. Those across my broadcast table can never slap themselves on the back or the breast and say, look how great we are and were, because they're at the storm center. It takes a totally disconnected, emotionally remote outsider who simply appreciated and loved their efforts for so many years to mount the bony finger of indignation and stick it in whoever's face or faces is responsible for the going things and doing places. Going places and doing things.
Getting emotional now.
No longer. Whoever's responsible for that no longer being a listening imperative in American life is partly responsible for the condition we're in. I want to pass around a record album. This is Bob and Ray, and you'll forgive the fact that they put their bar mitzvah pictures on the front cover here.
This is younger then.
Yeah, this is Bob and this is Ray. It's been confirmed. And I want you to look at the back cover of the album because they have, most of the little things on this album came from Monitor. If you see a spot you remember and would like to hear again, make a little note, because during this broadcast we're going to replay part of the Bob and Ray humor from Monitor. Steve White.
Barry, you were talking before about the kind of people that were out in the field that did so many tape recordings for us, and some of the things that happened that never got on the air sounded actually like Bob and Ray material, and we brought a few of them along tonight. Maybe you'd like to hear this one. It's a situation.
Joe, are you with me? I'm talking to my engineer now.
Where's my clothes, we'll call it, all right? And this actually happened. It was our sports editor,
Roy Silver,
who was talking to a fellow named Kit Carson White and trying to get him to do a tag. Why don't you listen to this?
It was a terrific race. The weather was clear. And people gave quite an ovation to Buddy Werner when he came in his last effort to unseat the champion.
Where's my clothes?
What?
Where the hell is the clothes? Will you identify yourself and say it now back to Monitor and Radio Central?
All right. Ready? I'll take five. This is Kit Carson White, a ski reporter from San Francisco. I'd like to return you back to Monitor in San Francisco.
Look, Kit, you say this. Your name is Kit Carson White?
Yes.
Would you please say, this is Kit Carson White in Squaw Valley, now back to Monitor and Radio Central.
All right. This is Kit Carson White from Squaw Valley, now back to Radio Monitor.
Let's try it again. It's Monitor and Radio Central.
Monitor in Radio Central. All right. This is Kit Carson White, Squaw Valley, and now back to Radio Monitor in Central.
Kid, let's try it slow this time, huh?
Well, let me write it down. There's the people coming in.
It's Monitor and Radio Central.
Monitor and Radio Central. All right. This is Kit Carson White from Squaw Valley, and now back to Monitor and Radio Central.
Well, I feel exalted because you've taken me and my listeners backstage. But in a way, I feel as depressed as if we had heard Churchill belch before he said, we will fight them on the beaches. We will never surrender if our empire should last 1,000 years. I don't want to hear anything but Churchill fighting them, and I don't want to hear anything but the perfection that I heard for 20 years.
Well, you have to see behind the scenes once in a while.
To know how much work it is.
But now, if you want to get perfection, we ought to get something like Bob and Ray. Because they were. And Bud worked, did most of the producing with them.
Well, Bob and Ray at that time, when we first went on the air, they used to come and spend almost the entire weekend there. And they sat in a separate little booth by themselves. And when we needed material, we would just go to them and they'd do 2 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever we needed. And they'd fill in for us, and there was always a gem. And I noticed on the album that you passed around, there are two that I do remember.
Do you really?
Oh, yes.
I did an awful lot of...
Yeah.
All right, Steve White has seen it. Cappy Patrash is looking at it. Bob and Ray have personally given me permission to, as a matter of fact, in the next stanza, we'll hear from Bob and Ray. I managed to get them over microphones to get their views on the 20-year sweep of Monitor. And they gave me this album, and they said, listen, most of these spots are from Monitor. Play what you like. Well, I looked over the titles, and I didn't see some of the things that I remember most. Remember they used to say a song?
Oh, Napoli Attire.
Napoli Attire.
Absolutely.
She had a drummer. What was the drummer?
Eddie.
Eddie would drum
Eddie
something.
Was not very talented, and maybe that's why Natalie never made it big. I've never been quite sure.
Yeah, she would say in that great strident voice of some, you know, any of the ballads recited to a martial drum roll. You have to be absolutely insane, and this was one of their regular features. They do that every week.
And her visit to a Swiss cheese factory to talk to the man who made the holes. I mean, just beautiful stuff. As a matter of fact, I forget all in all how long Bob and Ray were on the show, but people as late as 2 months ago, they've been all for years, you know, came over to join you all here. But people have said, you know, I love your show, and I love that Bob and Ray.
They still hear the voices. They're not with us. They were really, you know, you said Monitor in the old days, in the very beginning, oh, I said, oh, yeah, Bob and Ray. It was almost a single word. Bob and Ray.
And then it was Nichols and May.
It became Nichols and May.
Elaine May.
We came up with one after another, the great, you know, comedy teams. And we had endless amounts of comedy, not just with Bob and Ray, Bob Hope, Ernie Kovacs. You work with Ernie.
Ernie Kovacs.
He's come in with his $1 cigars, and he'd do spots for us.
We had Duffy's Tavern, Fiddler McGee and Molly. We resurrected a bunch of old classics from old radio.
We turned these things out, you know, 40 and 50 and 60 spots every weekend, and that was in addition to these going places, the music. We had lots of music, too, and it wasn't just...
And news.
you know, rigidly structured. You had to play this record. We played almost anything we wanted.
Right.
We played some odd bit of classical music. We played Duke Ellington following.
You know, the closest I ever came to writing a letter to a network, and I told this to Pat Weaver, I take full blame, like John F. Kennedy took blame for the Bay of Pigs, I take blame right now for not having Pat Weaver from the West Coast on our beeper phone, because I talked to him within the past 4 days. He promised me he would. I failed to call him at the appointed hour to set up the beeper, and he's now at a party right this minute on the West Coast, and that's why we're not talking to him right now. But I told him the one letter, I've never written a letter to a radio station or a radio network or television, either one. I've written letters to newspapers. But I told him the one letter I wanted most to write and almost did and didn't. And he said, gee, I wish you had. It would have been a good idea. See, I structured my life around your work. I deliberately traveled. I was a bachelor. And I could do what I wanted. And what I wanted to do was listen to Monitor. And I deliberately traveled. I was working for TV Guide magazine in the Deep South. If you think the day pastrami came to Charlotte, North Carolina was cosmic, you should have seen the day Monitor satire came to Galax, Virginia. I was there. You know, and it was life-lifting. It really was. And I remember driving, listening to Monitor. Don't forget, we don't have the multi-megaton, megawatt big stations like the North does. We had little NBC stations that were sometimes 250 watts, 500 watts. And when you plan your weekend listening to Monitor, you drive, and 35 miles later, the signal gets weak.
Right.
And I wanted to write a letter suggesting that every hour on the hour, you make those beeps 3 times longer so that those of us driving can sweep our dials and switch from one NBC station
to the nearest station, right?
Another,
right.
You know? And I wish I had, because I lost. I almost hit a couple people, a couple cars, couple turtles, merely trying to find the next strongest NBC station down the necklace from the one that was fading as I was driving and listening.
Talking about turtles, I remember we had snapping turtles on the show, too. I guess you must remember if you heard all those early shows, Barry, but we really collected odd sounds, and people would send those in to us, too. It's amazing how much participation there was in that show from people other than on staff. I think a lot of people felt very enthusiastic about the show, and I was talking before about Lee Klein, the farm reporter at WHO in Des Moines.
He sent us on raccoon hunts.
Right. And he gave us a story on Dynamite Pedrick, a man whose business was dynamiting beaver dams, and he'd never lost a finger or a toe, and about a farmer that every winter entertained about 200 guests he didn't expect as their car would break down on the snowy roads. And it's this kind of story that just doesn't appear anyplace else.
We got a good feeling of America, which is... Yep. Really rare.
Lee was really a superb reporter. When if a story broke like a tornado in WHO area, he was out there talking. He was marvelous. Just he sounded so middle American.
And it wasn't all nutty stuff. We carried news as it broke. We covered everything that was happening in the world. Really, we used to feel it.
Right.
We were really at the middle of it, and we got it out to everybody. And we did have a devoted. Bunch of listeners. And we love doing it. I mean, it was, they talk about, you want a job that you're really happy in, and I think we all were lucky in getting at least that much for that long. And if it's going down, it's going down, but we had great times.
WOR, New York, when we reconvene, we'll hear a little burst that I did with Bob and Ray.
Good idea.
You won't believe it's I, but it's in my younger days when I had a voice. You will definitely recognize Bob and Ray because they had the same voice as they did when they both had these faces on the front cover of their album, Vintage Bob and Ray. I can't wait to hear which bursts you of Monitor have nominated. This is Radio Free Monitor. This is a little nodule in a nebula that will continue to appreciate the finest that American radio has offered. Now, in the 30s, we offered everything because there was no television. when television reached in like an aggressive sponge and sucked up most of what we were able to produce over broadcasting, there remained a monitor able to land an uppercut on the vulnerable chin of television to upstage, to humiliate, to dramatize the lasting power of radio to do more significant things than television ever did. Has television ever given us a monitor? I mean, has television ever taken us lovingly by the hand for an entire weekend to worthy places, introduced us to worthy people worthily? Well, radio did. Not for a brief time, but for, thank God, almost 20 years. And I just hope somehow the reincarnation can be swift and in my lifetime. I hate to think that something as good as Monitor is going to disappear like an Alka-Seltzer under Niagara Falls in a deluge of rock and roll records played on all the independent stations that could still be joining hands and hearts in lifting us up to the level of a monitor that could take us to a press conference in a European capital, take us to look at some mysterious Bigfoot tracks in Oregon, interview the people in the tumult of Indonesia. These are places that I was acquainted with by monitor at no cost. And I just lament the fact that, well, I just wish monitor had lost a fair fight. I wish there'd been something else to come along to shove them aside, instead of a mere vacuum which says something that as an American I don't want to hear, namely value, worthiness, merit has been called off for lack of interest. The people I'm interested in are the people who made Monitor interesting. They're across my table right now: Steve White, Bud Drake, Charles Garmett, and Cappy Petrash. I've got a tape with Bob and Ray. You won't believe it's I doing it. You'll think I'm bragging, but it's way back when I had a voice. Can we listen to Bob and Ray now and pipe it into the studio so we can all hear? And then throughout the entire broadcast, we'll pelt and pepper our proceedings with little Bob and Ray pellets, okay?
If it weren't for the two partners across the microphones right now, I don't think I would have ever wanted to enter broadcasting. Of course, Bob and Ray know of their power. When you're in this business, you can look outside from inside the fishbowl just like people can look in at you. But I always wondered if Bob and Ray realized that there must have been hundreds, thousands, even millions of people who pinwheeled around them as a very important part of our lives when Monitor first began. When I first discovered Bob and Ray, I did not live in the Boston area, so I entered the Bob and Ray awareness relatively late in life. It took NBC's Monitor to make me aware that there was a Bob and a Ray and that they fit very well together. I used to plan my entire work schedule so that I could travel on weekends just so as to hear Bob and Ray, and I used to wait somewhat impatiently until they kept coming up. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be working and living this close to you right now again.
Oh, thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
I always wondered if you would dare do a straight interview. I mean, really answer straight questions, or
somehow
this was calling upon you to violate some article of religious faith.
Well, you know, we've done so many, fictitious or satirical interviews that anything we do now sounds like our own satire, you know. So much of our humor has been based on interviewing, you know, people who are essentially phony or crazy or something. So it'll be interesting to see how this all comes out. But you bring back a whole flood of memories, though, when you talk about way back when Monitor started. That was the resurgence of network radio. You know, they just about put network radio away before Pat Weaver had the idea to put Monitor on the air. And it was great. It was very exciting. And everything was live. No tape. Everything was live when we first went on the air with Monitor. And that was our original purpose, aside from being, you know, trying to insert humor every once in a while. They had us in a little booth. In case of a line failure, they would cut to us and we would do a takeoff on what they were going to do. I remember one time they were going to... Jack LaLanne has those... health plan.
Yeah.
He was going to swim across San Francisco Bay from Alcatraz with his hands cuffed and a rock around his leg and everything. And they cut to San Francisco and there was a line failure. So they turn it over to us, and I'm Bob interviewing me as a Jack LaLanne type character. And that's how it all
happened. He's got to swim out to the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, right. Through the grapefruit halves and waxed paper and everything.
So that's
but it's
the
hard to
origin
think
of some of those.
Right. That, that seems not too long ago, you know, although it is in years, I suppose, but it's hard to think that radio was not that perfected in 1955 when they went on the air, that it would break down and they'd have to have live film.
It's a beautiful part of Monitor. It was all live, and when they cut to San Francisco, it was right then, and it wasn't on tape done a week ago Tuesday, you know.
I've seen quarterbacks take a busted play in football and make 20 yards out
right.
of it, but you all ritualistically took lemons and turned them into lemonade.
Because well, we'd been working that way for 10 years before Monitor began.
Yeah.
Five in Boston and then five here in New York.
Let me knife back into prehistory for one helping. I first became aware of you, as I said, when Monitor ricocheted across the nation. What, I'm not going to make you reenact your entire biography because you've got to dart into a studio adjacent to here and go back to real life work of the present year. But when did you first realize that you had this chemistry together? Do you recall the circumstances?
Well, sure, I recall it very well. I was essentially a very straight announcer doing news and so forth. And Bob was a disc jockey playing records. And I would just stick around in the studio after I did the news and kibitz and kid and have fun. And that's how it all happened. And we realized we were on the same wavelength, I guess, for humor right then and there.
Then we began to add characters, which we had dreamed up based on real people, for the most part. And so we peopled our shows with imaginary people.
Did this mixture ignite on contact to the air? Did you get any, by now, historic memos from station higher-ups saying, quit monkeying around and teasing the business that gives you your living and do your jobs right?
No, actually, we didn't. So we took that as tacit approval of what we were doing. We didn't get any memos saying, cut it out. So we just kept on, and finally it developed into the Bob and Ray Show. And that's how it all happened.
We use Bob and Ray around our office as a whipping club when somebody makes the kind of mistake that you would have been there to fill in for,
right.
Or when somebody has me on the air with the wrong person. Like, for instance, once upon a time, there were three Kims prominent in the film industry. I'm not going to mention their names because they're all alive and well, and I want each one to guess who's Kim 1, 2, and 3. But anyhow, Tex McCrary was my boss, and I booked Kim 1 thinking it was Kim 2, and he approved thinking it was Kim 3. That was a Bob and Ray moment on the Tex McCrary show. Sometimes my beeper phone doesn't work. Sometimes I have literally the wrong person. And I'm thinking back, I remember where I was when I heard various of your things. And I've told you this in the halls, but at the risk of detaining you for an extra minute or two, I just have to tell you. Now, this is imprint. I'm going back 20 years.
Yeah.
I remember, for instance, your bit about used personal Christmas cards. And I was driving in Washington, D.C. by a People's Drug Store right beside the White House. Dissolve and fade, and we come back up on a takeoff on Person to Person, where you were visiting Mitch Miller. do you remember the stuff of that particular spot? It was the wrong Mitch Miller, you know?
Yeah, well, we always had that. We'd be interviewing Art Linkletter, and we'd find us in the interview when it was the wrong Art Linkletter. The Art Linkletter that Bob was talking to had a linoleum store in Mineola, Long Island, and it wasn't the Art Linkletter he thought he had.
There are a lot of Art Linkletters around, you know. Well, it's easy to find the wrong one.
This particular Mitch Miller, one of you, incidentally, do you know that even right this minute, I don't know which one of you is which when I'm listening. Sometimes, it's just such a perfect cross-fertilization of function. I don't know which of you was asking and which of you was answering, but the one who was supposed to be Edward R. Murrah interviewing Mitch Miller was getting increasingly impatient and said, well, you know, what are you producing this season? And he said, well, producing this? Well, yeah, you know, your company produces, well, we've got a new 14-inch flange that we're very proud of. Anyhow, it turns out he runs a plumbing supply thing in Wisconsin somewhere.
I said, now, you're not the Mitch Miller.
Well, and he always takes umbrage. He is the Mitch Miller. In his opinion, he's the Mitch Miller.
Yeah, but of course, the classic line to anybody who works in the vineyards of radio was the end line of that piece, which was the boss of the show turning to whoever made the mistake and saying, really, Elmer, in the future, you must be more careful. And one that every single broadcaster knows and fears. I remember the snowplow. You were interviewing somebody about the emotions that well through his breast and consciousness as he sits astride that piece of gigantic modern equipment and sets forth to make the city not just safe, but absolutely tidy in spite of nature at her rampaging work. What feelings well up with... And then, of course, what do you mean by that?
Yeah,
that,
right.
That happens.
Sure.
That happens.
Yeah.
And when it happens in spite of my precautions, I go rampaging back to my production tent saying, you cast me in the middle of a Bob and Ray show.
Yeah. But, you know, all those things are ad-libbed, and people recall things, and we don't remember all of them. So much of that was, spontaneous, right off the cuff. So that, you know, people will recall something like that, the fellow with the snowplow. I don't. But I'm sure we did it, you know. But we just don't remember.
We did snowplow and street sweeper.
Well, we've done so.
I remember asking him what happens when that big brush goes around. Where does the dirt go? And he answers, it just gets lost.
It just goes somewhere. We don't care, just so long as it's not where it was when we started.
Did you ever get an idea for a new Bob and Ray bit from a well-meaning admirer's version of an old one?
Yes, I think maybe we have. We might go do a thing this afternoon a little bit later on snowplows.
Sure. We had been on NBC, 4 years prior to that. But it certainly did great things for us nationally by being on there every weekend.
Mm. And we saw people start, like David Brinkley first started right on monitor. And Hugh Downs, and I remember Dave Garraway. The first monitor was on a Sunday afternoon. It was simulcast. Pat Weaver had the TV cameras roll in, and it was on both radio and TV, you know, the kickoff program. Boy, that seems like so long ago now, though. Gee, Dave Garraway and...
It was the weekend of my high school reunion, I think.
I think it was. That's right, it was.
I wasn't able to attend.
Well, if my old pal Don Freeman, who sneaked illegally with me into the NBC building at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in 1956, so that we could sneak up the back stairs to the fifth floor, which was your infabled Radio Central. Reason for sneaking was because if we had taken the tour, we would have been outside that glass cage for 3.5 minutes, and they'd have pushed us along.
Right.
And I wanted to stay there long enough to see you two in action, and Don Freeman sneaked along with me at risk of being caught and ejected. If he's listening now, he will know how good it feels for me to be 3 feet away and no glass in between. Thank you very much, Bob and Ray, and continued good things to you.
Thank you, Barry.
Now, No chairman railroaded this through, but by not acclamation, but assiduous nomination, this is the first Bob and Ray burst from the old monitor that we are reincarnating at this time.
Well, Ray, that bomb interview is here.
Goodness sakes. Wilbur!
Hello, Bob and Ray.
Wilbur Feely, the world-famous bomb deactivator, back again.
Thank you very much.
Tell us, where have your travels been taking you?
Well, mostly back to the doctor for checkups.
Since the last
time. Since the last bomb deactivation experimentation.
Uh-huh. Well, now here in this huge box, I gather, is what would be considered a blockbuster, right?
That's right. This is a small, comparatively small, 30-pounder.
Mm-hmm.
That I brought along for experimental purposes. It is much similar to the last one, which I deactivated unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, now, Wilbur, again, I think...
I'm going to step out now, Ray, if you can carry on.
I think Bob and I will go outside, and I think it would be better if you just described what you were doing, Wilbur.
Well, all right.
As you go along.
If I may have that lapel microphone.
All right. And good luck to you, Wilbur. I'll see you around.
No danger in your staying here, if you care to. I've got my tools here and my lapel microphone. The bomb is on the table. First, we have to remove the nose cone or cap. And we do that very carefully so as not to jingle the bomb. Now we Just lay it on the table. There. This exposes the three wires, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the green, the red, and the blue. The secret, of course, in deactivating a bomb successfully is to snip the wires in the proper succession. Blue, green, and red is the way I guess this one is set up. So first, we carefully snip the blue one. And everything is okay. Now it's a toss-up between the green or the red. Doesn't really make too much difference at this point, because it's after you snip two that something could go wrong if the other one remaining is the wrong one. So I'll snip the red one. And two-thirds of our job is done. Now, it's a matter of snipping the third or the green wire. The bomb then will be completely deactivated. I'm just going to turn my head slightly the other way as I snip number three.
Obviously the work of a sound effects man, and Bud, you have a terrific story about the engineer that worked with Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah. Later on, when we did go to tape with Bob and Ray, because they just couldn't come in all weekend long, every weekend, we used to work with a brilliant sound effect man by the name of Johnny Powers, who's still with the company. And John was just as fruity and nutty as they were, and had to anticipate, because everything was ad lib with them, and John had to be ready with a whole tray of sound effects to do whatever they wanted him to do. But he just loved these two guys so much that he used to do the whole show with a handkerchief in his mouth, because he used to fracture in the studio. He'd keep breaking up and ruining the spot. So he worked with it. It looked like his lung was hanging out. He walked around with this big handkerchief in his mouth. And the boys always used to say to me, why is it that everybody treats us as though we were one person? People will come in and say, may I take your coat, Bob and Ray? That's true. They had such an identity as a team.
I refused to join a tour, because it wouldn't have kept me in front of Radio Central for long enough. But there were organized tours. Could you get any feedback from the power that monitor had, from the intensity of the people who were on those NBC tours on the weekends?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we used to actually go out and talk, you know, we'd send whoever the host was at the time, we'd go out and we'd talk with the tours and find out, you know, where the people were from, what they thought about the show, whether they'd heard it back home. And in those days, when you said, you know, you hear us back in wherever it was, in Sioux Falls, they all heard us. They all knew it. And they, you know, it wasn't a surprise to them when they came by and they saw the monitor was on the air. They knew monitor because that was everybody's show then.
You see, monitor never pandered. Monitor lifted.
We put on what we thought we wanted to put on that would be entertaining or informative, and we didn't have these, as I say, we weren't bound in by any kind of a formal, you know, you had to do one of these, one of those, and you didn't dare touch this. We put things on, if they bombed out, they bombed out, but we had a pretty good score. We had some lunacies and some idiocies, but even those were kind of fun. And but if something else that came up in that spot you did with Bob and Ray earlier, I think it was Ray started to list some of the hosts we had, you know, Brinkley, and
Calderon.
We have had almost anybody in the business work there, you know, around those microphones in Radio Central through the years. Mm-hmm. He mentioned
Garraway.
Hugh Downs, Garraway.
Right. Clifton Fadiman,
mm-hmm. The information please.
Walter Kiernan.
Peter Roberts.
Oh, right. Good friend of yours.
Yes. Morgan Beatty, mm-hmm. Al Jazbo. It was a great team. We had Morgan Beatty, who was the epitome of a very strong newsman type, and Al Collins, who did a purple grotto, hip jazz kind of thing, and we paired them, and the contrast of the two was marvelous. I mean, they played well against each other. They would exchange roles once in a while. There were others. We had
then we went to our
movie stars, right.
Syndrome. We had David Wayne. And Barry Nelson,
Gary Merrill, Van Johnson,
right.
Tony Randall.
Tony Randall came in and drove us up the wall because Tony, as you know, is not of this world, and he just thought we gave him a program for himself. And he went on for hours with insane stories about seagulls. He came up with one of the world's greatest puns, one of those puns about the seagulls have been chasing him around, and his wife gave him a... told him to fight them off, and he ended up with leave no turn on stones. And we almost went up the air with that one.
Did anybody ever bring my dream to life? Did anybody ever record on his own private machinery a 3-minute spot and send it into you cold with no connections, no agent, no
phone? Oh, yeah. Sure. All the time.
And
all
have it on.
All the time. Some of our best people, they might have worked for stations, but it would be a very small station. Well, I think Dell was working for a small station at one time. And I remember Paul Mason was sort of our, he had no station affiliation at
That's
all.
That's right.
And he was our itinerant reporter, and he'd turn up, you know, at the mouth of the Amazon eating oatmeal and talking to the chef.
Well, Jay Miller was another one who would come out of the desert with the sound of, you know, two rattlesnakes mating.
Or somebody panning gold.
That's right. You could use that nowadays.
I don't know. I think the fun comes through. I think even just talking about it, you can see how much fun we had. And I think it came through on the show.
Mm-hmm. We really covered, you know, we said we took you on a tour of the weekend world. We actually did. And it wasn't, you know, just in our country, although it was primarily, you know, based on America, but we got stuff from wherever anything was, or that entire thing where Dick Jennings went off to Rome to get back on a plane with Ingrid Bergman.
Get her first interview.
You know about that, yeah.
Her return to the States.
No, she left in Stromboli and that sort of thing.
And he somehow engineered a seat next to her in the airplane coming home. And he finally got the interview for us, and we got the first interview that she had given after her.
And I got that story not from Dick Jennings, but from Ingrid Bergman, who nominated Dick Jennings as the best interviewer she ever met. General Patton had his tanks run ahead of his fuel all the time, at risk of running ahead of my fuel right now. We're going to open... Gee whiz, is it really fading? I thought I'd get stronger as we went along. We're going to... open monitors centerfold in the next stanza of the broadcast. Leo Lowndes is on the telephone right now trying to reach Miss Monitor, who I knew had a real name. Her name is Teddy Thurman, and she's alive and well and still young and beautiful in California, and Leo's trying to reach her. We'll reconvene in the upcoming stanza. First, WOR, New York.